Are you funding your lifestyle with debt?
That is a pretty heavy question right out of the gate.
It is, I know. But think about it for a second. Does true happiness come from a perfectly balanced budget?
Or are we culturally conditioned to seek it through a maxed out credit card?
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a fascinating and frankly provocative link between a nation's fiscal discipline and the actual measurable happiness of its citizens.
It's such a critical question for anyone trying to understand modern macroeconomics and, well, personal well-being too. Today, we're specifically contrasting the Nordic model of financial restraint with American consumerism.
Right, looking at how systemic financial habits filter all the way down to individual psychology?
Exactly.
To guide us through this, we're relying on a single piece of source material today. It's a New Year's editorial titled, "The Happiest Nations Aren't Drunk on Credit," written by Brent Lambie.
And Lambie brings a really compelling dual perspective to this topic. He has a background in accounting, graduating from the University of Northern Iowa back in 1982.
You and I, class of 82.
Yeah. And he also holds a law degree from Creighton University, class of 1985. So he's looking at this through the lenses of both hard numbers and systemic legal structures.
The visual presentation of this original editorial is highly intentional, too. The text sits against a striking background of a draped American flag.
Yeah, before you even read a single word, that imagery sets the tone. It signals a deep critique of national identity, the American cultural ethos, and how those concepts intersect with economic reality.
Okay, let's unpack this. The core premise Lambie outlines is incredibly timely. He points out that as Americans celebrate the new year, you know, raising a glass to new beginnings, they're actively ignoring a sobering macroeconomic truth.
A very sobering truth. The happiest nations on earth, the ones that consistently top the global charts for life satisfaction, they didn't achieve that deep contentment by leveraging themselves to the hilt.
No, they didn't get there by treating their primary residences like ATM machines.
Right. And they certainly didn't do it by gambling their futures on speculative bubbles dressed up to look like technological innovation.
Yeah.
The author argues that these nations achieved their happiness through a concept that is often anathema to modern consumer culture. Discipline.
Both on a personal household level and a sweeping governmental level. They practice restraint. They share this collective cultural understanding that any prosperity lacking underlying structural stability is just an illusion.
An illusion waiting to shatter.
Exactly.
Let's look at the actual countries pulling this off. But before we do, I have to ask, if the U.S. economy is largely driven by aggressive consumer spending, isn't that what fuels the global engine?
Sure, it is.
So how does Lambie reconcile that with the idea that these smaller, more conservative nations are somehow doing it better?
Well, what's fascinating here is how the author breaks down the top five happiest nations to answer that exact point. When you look at the global happiness and life satisfaction rankings year after year, they consistently tell a story that challenges the American consumer model.
In what way?
The most content populations on the planet tend to live in countries that practice what Lambie calls boring, unglamorous, fiscally responsible habits. He argues that while consumerism might drive temporary GDP spikes, it doesn't drive sustainable human contentment.
I love that phrase, boring and unglamorous. Let's dig into the mechanics of how the Nordic Five actually practice these habits, starting with Finland.
Okay.
According to the source, Finland's happiness is built on a high trust in institutions, incredibly low corruption, strong social safety nets, and very modest consumer debt.
Right. And it isn't just a cultural accident. It is a deliberate structural choice to prioritize collective stability over individual leverage.
Moving over to Denmark, their formula involves maintaining balanced budgets, high wages, and low inequality.
But crucially, the author points out a stark psychological difference here. Danish citizens simply don't confuse happiness with consumption. Those are two entirely separate concepts in their culture.
They aren't seeking dopamine hits through retail therapy.
Or leveraged lifestyle upgrades, exactly.
Ooh, no. Let's talk about Iceland, because their story is a massive departure from the others.
Oh, completely.
They aren't just naturally cautious. They went through a brutal trial by fire. Iceland is a nation that learned some very hard lessons after a catastrophic financial collapse. But instead of burying their heads in the sand or printing their way out of it, they chose reform over denial.
They faced the music in a way that most global superpowers refuse to do. During their 2008 banking crisis, rather than implementing massive quantitative easing or bailing out their financial sector with taxpayer debt,
they just let them fail.
Effectively, yes.
Yeah.
They let their overly leveraged banks fail. They prioritized the preservation of the sovereign state over the preservation of speculative banking institutions.
Which is wild to think about.
It was a painful, immediate shock, but it purged the system of toxic leverage and established a foundation of reality-based economics moving forward.
Looking at Sweden next, the author highlights their focus on long-term investment in human capital rather than chasing what he calls short-term political sugar highs. They're playing a generational long game.
And finally, that brings us to Norway. Lambie goes so far as to describe Norway as the gold standard of fiscal adulthood.
The gold standard. To understand why this matters to you, the listener, we have to look at the macroeconomic why behind these rankings.
Right. In these Nordic nations, consumer confidence is exceptionally high. But it's not high because credit is cheap and liquidity is flooding the market.
It's high because daily life is predictable.
Yes. The institutions are fundamentally solvent. The citizens of these countries don't wake up feeling like a financial ambush is waiting for them.
Whether that's a sudden healthcare crisis or a massive inflation spike driven by national debt.
Exactly. Their peace of mind is rooted in tangible solvency, not in their ability to borrow against tomorrow.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The editorial doesn't just praise the Nordic countries in a vacuum. It makes a direct, incredibly sharp comparison between Norway and the United States, presenting a stark tale of two entirely different economic futures.
Let's look at Norway's approach first. Norway sits on top of a sovereign wealth fund that is worth well over $1 trillion. This massive fund was built directly from their North Sea oil revenues.
Right.
But instead of injecting all that cash into their current economy to fund an immediate euphoric boom, or using it to drastically slash current taxes to zero, they explicitly saved it for future generations.
They structured the fund to cap withdrawals, generally limiting them to the expected real return of the investments.
Right, meaning the principal remains untouched, growing in perpetuity. They asked themselves a radical question. What if we didn't spend everything today and leave our children the bill?
But taking a step back, isn't that inherently easier for a nation of about 5 million people sitting on massive, highly lucrative offshore oil reserves compared to a complex, massive economy like the U.S.?
The author acknowledges the vast resources involved, but he pivots the argument to focus on the choices made with the resources available. The United States is incredibly blessed with unmatched natural resources, incredible technological innovation, and top-tier global talent.
Yet, according to Lambie, America has chosen a completely different fiscal path.
A path of permanent deficit spending. It engages in serial debt ceiling theater in politics, cultivating a culture that is essentially addicted to postponing pain. Lambie notes that record government debt isn't even treated as an emergency anymore.
It's just background noise.
Just accepted background noise.
I want to share the author's sharpest summary of this dynamic because it really distills his entire thesis. He writes, "Norway plans for grandchildren. America refinances for spring break."
Wow.
Yeah. And just to pause here for a second, we are looking strictly at the author's economic philosophy today. We are impartially unpacking the arguments presented in our source material, which is highly critical of the U.S. fiscal approach. We are not taking a political side or endorsing any specific ideology regarding government spending, taxation, or national policy.
We're just exploring how Lambie connects these fiscal strategies to national happiness. And that critique is essential to understanding the author's broader point. He's arguing that this macro-level governmental behavior directly trickles down to the micro-level. When a government constantly borrows to fund its current lifestyle, it normalizes that behavior.
And it deeply impacts the financial psychology of the everyday citizen.
Precisely.
Lambie maps out what he calls the tragic circle of the American balance sheet. It's this weird psychological trap where the addiction to easy money becomes embedded at the household level.
He details this specific cyclical trap. It usually starts when someone decides to refinance their home because interest rates have dropped.
Right. They take that newly available home equity and use it to fund vacations, buy new cars, or generally upgrade their lifestyle.
Then they use whatever's left over to pay off their maxed out credit cards.
And at that moment, they feel incredibly wealthy.
Oh, they feel like they have a clean slate.
Yeah.
But because they paid off those revolving balances, their credit utilization drops and their credit card limits suddenly increase.
The banks see them as a prime borrower again. So basically, people are treating their home equity like a winning lottery ticket, paying off the cards, and then the banks just raise their limits, practically inviting them to spend again.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the author is very clear that this cycle is not wealth creation. It is the illusion of prosperity. He refers to it as financial musical chairs.
Financial musical chairs.
You're just moving debt from one ledger, the credit card, to another ledger, the mortgage. And the terrifying part of financial musical chairs on a macroeconomic scale is what happens when the music finally stops.
When interest rates go up or housing prices experience a correction.
Right. Millions of people are left standing with negative equity.
And negative equity doesn't just hurt the individual. It freezes the whole system, doesn't it?
It does. It raises an important question about systemic health. When an entire populace is underwater on their mortgages, labor mobility completely freezes. People literally cannot afford to sell their homes to move across the country for a better job opportunity.
Which stifles economic growth, innovation, and recovery.
The Alto argues that consumer confidence in America is actually incredibly fragile because it is fundamentally artificial. It's built on teaser rates, it's built on making minimum payments, and it's built on this comforting but mathematically false lie that tomorrow's growth will always somehow bail out today's excess.
It's a house of cards mentality, and the source material doesn't stop at traditional banking and real estate. Lambie takes this exact same framework of critique and applies it to one of the most heavily debated modern financial trends, cryptocurrency.
Oh, yes. He refers to it as the ultimate modern speculation engine.
He deconstructs the massive hype surrounding crypto with some very harsh economic logic. Crypto is constantly sold to the public as a populist rebellion. It's pitched as true financial freedom, a hedge against inflation, and the inevitable future of decentralized money.
But the author argues, in reality, it behaves remarkably like a casino floor, just one with much better branding.
A casino floor with better branding, which is incredibly accurate. I mean, at least in Vegas, you get a free watered-down cocktail while you lose your money. In crypto, you just lose it staring at a Discord server at 2 in the morning. He points out that the prices in these markets don't rise based on traditional, solid financial metrics.
The contrast he draws is between productive assets and speculative assets. A productive asset generates cash flow, it has real-world productivity, or it provides long-term utility. A farm produces food, a factory produces goods.
But the author argues these speculative digital assets rise almost entirely on momentum and belief.
It relies on the greater fool theory, the idea that you can always sell an overvalued asset because there will always be a greater fool willing to pay an even higher price.
It works beautifully, and everyone feels like a financial genius.
Until the momentum shifts and the liquidity evaporates.
To drive this point home, the author lays down three very powerful maxims that effectively dismantle this speculative mindset. I want to read these three takeaways exactly as they appear in the source because they strip away the jargon and force you to look at the cold, hard reality of what is happening with capital allocation.
Go for it.
Maxim number one, speculation is not a retirement plan. Maxim number two, volatility is not innovation. And maxim number three, hope is not a balance sheet.
Those statements force a massive reality check. They challenge the investor to ask themselves, are you building a foundational portfolio based on underlying value, or are you just participating in a high-tech version of a chain letter?
That's a great question.
The author sees this massive cultural shift toward speculation as a symptom of a broader societal desperation. People feel they can no longer build wealth through traditional saving and discipline, so they turn to the financial slot machines.
So what does this all mean? How does all of this connect back to you, the listener, and your own pursuit of happiness? The editorial suggests that if we want to achieve the kind of deep systemic contentment seen in those Nordic countries, we need a massive shift in our cultural obsessions.
The happiest countries are not sitting around constantly obsessing over rising home prices. They aren't fixated on the Federal Reserve securing ever lower interest rates so they can borrow more capital.
And most importantly, they do not use endless consumption as a substitute for finding actual meaning, community, or purpose in their lives.
But there's a trade-off. We can't gloss over that. They make specific, tangible sacrifices to achieve this peace of mind. It isn't a utopia where everyone gets everything they want.
There is absolutely a trade-off, and this is a vital part of the author's thesis on socioeconomic systems. The citizens of these happier nations accept conditions that many Americans might fiercely reject.
On average, they live in smaller homes. They deliberately carry far less personal debt, meaning they might drive older cars or skip the luxury vacations funded by credit.
And yes, they accept paying significantly higher taxes.
They accept those conditions because they're buying something else, right? They're buying stability.
They have a cultural consensus that deep foundational security is the true bedrock of happiness, not the ability to leverage yourself to buy more consumer goods.
They happily trade the high-flying, debt-fueled boom-and-bust lifestyle for the ironclad guarantee that a medical emergency, a sudden job loss, or a global economic downturn won't completely destroy their family's future.
They are optimizing for a high floor, whereas the American model optimizes for a limitless ceiling.
But with a terrifyingly deep basement.
Which brings us to Lambie's stark New Year's warning to the public. To recap his final message, he argues that America does not suffer from a lack of money. The gross domestic product is massive. The wealth is clearly there. What America lacks, fundamentally, is discipline.
The author grounds this warning in deep historical context. History is incredibly clear on what happens to a sovereign nation that becomes addicted to easy credit and speculative excess.
Eventually, that nation faces a brutal reckoning.
Interest rates inevitably rise to combat inflation, asset prices fall as liquidity dries up, financial options shrink, and all that artificial debt-fueled confidence is completely shattered.
Lambie notes that great empires do not collapse because they simply ran out of wealth. They collapse from pretending that their debts, both public and private, don't matter.
And while those happiest nations we talked about are quietly keeping their books balanced and ensuring their grandchildren's futures are fully funded, America, according to the author, just keeps ordering another round, totally convinced that the bartender is never actually going to bring the bill.
But, as Lambie ominously notes at the very end of his piece, the bill always arrives.
It is a sobering macroeconomic thought to end a New Year's reflection on, but an incredibly necessary one if we want to truly understand the mechanics of sustainable national and personal happiness.
It really is, and it leaves us with a final provocative thought to mull over. We've spent this time unpacking Lambie's argument that financial stability drives true happiness. But take that a step further.
Okay.
Consider how our modern society's constant 24/7 access to instant credit might be doing more than just draining our wallets. Could it be actively rewiring our brains to be more anxious?
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. By constantly borrowing against our future wealth to fund today's desires, are we actually fundamentally borrowing against our future mental health? Are we inadvertently guaranteeing our future selves a state of perpetual stress and cognitive load just to have a slightly nicer lifestyle today?
That raises an important question about human psychology. It really reframes how we look at that piece of plastic in our wallet. It is not just an innocuous financial tool. It is a psychological instrument that dictates our future emotional state.
Something to really think about the next time you get an alert that your credit limit has been magically increased. Thank you so much for joining us for today's deep dive. We hope it gave you some valuable, hard-hitting perspective on the true systemic cost of credit and the boring, beautiful secret to national happiness. Remember to keep questioning the information around you, and we will catch you next time.